Bob, you were mentioning when you were going over the Dew Line that something about Zappa, that he didn't have a 19th century mind. What was that?
No. Yeah, Zappa was quadriphenic, like McLuhan. He was younger. He didn't have the cultural, literary, anthropological book knowledge that McLuhan had, but he applied the McLuhan technique to his approach to music. And McLuhan said that he would grab anything he could find as information to dump into his book about the effects of TV. Well, Zappa had a slogan, anything, anywhere at all for no reason, something like that. Anything, anywhere, everywhere for no reason at all. He would select sound. He was exploring the form of sound and its tactility in the electric age. So he did not specialize, but he had a theory. His theory was that the blue, early 20th century composers were looking at sound and how it came from speech, and sort of seeing the rhythms of speech were what classical composers were approximating. And Zappa said the blues singers solve that problem of mixing speech and music. So he was putting together the blues black culture with the European avant-garde culture. And that's why he would often do what's called Sprechstimme in German, Sprechstimme song, talking songs. So now that's McLuhan-esque, to point out that musical abstraction, composition, and beauty comes from speech. That's what McLuhan said.
You met him in 1950-something, right?
58.
When did you hear his first music? When did you hear his first time you heard his music? When was that?
Well, I'm going to look up the diary, and let's see how it's laid out in the diary. I don't think I heard his music. I had a few opportunities at his studio, but I didn't really hear his band till 66. Freakout had come out, or it was just around that time, and he was playing in L.A. before he moved to New York City. That was my first time. So let's see. I mentioned in the memo of Prince Charles. No, I don't. I mentioned the night I missed the Guambo, which was an art festival musical thing that they put on in L.A. It was the great Guambo, the great underground arts and masks ball. I think that was July 29th, 1966. And the night Zappa performed that night, and that was the night that Dylan had his motorcycle accident. And it was the night I got lost in L.A. and ended up almost busted by these police. So it was around that time, but not that night. But if you go back to 1958...
Yeah, February 4th.
You know what, they don't... Oh, yeah, February 4th. So it says, Bob slipped into the little club in the Mojave Desert and found a stool. Bo Diddley was taking a break, but a conversation caught Bob's attention. Quote, Frank, you believe the universe is a point of view, tight and tapered. I believe the universe doesn't, fast and bulbous. End of quote. The speaker had a baby face, but the aura of a woodsman. The Frank spoken to looked like many people Bob had seen around Jean-Paul Sartre's scene in Paris. Bob thought of Marsh McLuhan and Balbus. Balbus is the name in Portrait of the Artist's Young Man. Balbus was a Roman general or something. Balbus is building a wall. Think of the iron comes on, the wave meets the wall. Balbus is building a wall. It's a refrain throughout the Portrait of the Artist as a young artist. And Beefheart is saying, fast and bulbous. So I thought of Balbus. So then you move up to, can you go forward? What's the next date as you move up?
March 10th?
Early 60s.
Early 60s, okay.
April 20, I'll just go April 25th, 62, scanning back down. November 1st, 62. And I was in L.A. area looking into the UFO rumors. That was what my assignment was. Find out what's really going on there, because my bosses, they wanted to know whether this was real or not. See what's going on here. I'm supposed to go down this way. No, they're backwards. Okay. So, 62.
April 25th?
Yeah. So it looks like the first time... April 25th, 62 is the first time after... So I would occasionally go back to L.A., and I eventually found out that he was working in advertising in a place called Ontario, which was also Claremont, this area outside of L.A., and halfway to Lancaster. Okay, so you got here. November 1st, 1962, Cucamonga. That's where he started hanging out with Paul Buff, who had this recording, very advanced recording studio. So Frank got to learn, get the opportunity to hone his chops in the studio, his editing abilities. So I say, Frank, if you and Don Vliet are going to change the music business, then why not do it together? Zap says, we're going to do it together. We had a talk at a folk music club the other night where we agreed on a mutual goal. We hope to be able to make a movie, too. I think Don can carry a lead role. I say, that's great, but I want to hear you in the same band now. You will, Bob. You will soon. Then it says, Bob grinned and put another 45 RPM record on the turntable. He, Motorhead, and Frank sat back and contemplated Girl of My Dreams by the Cliques. We contemplated the doo-wop song. So he does form a band with Don a year or two later, and then he makes a movie called Captain Beefheart Meets the Grunt People in 64-65 period. So I only met him a few times in that period. Mm-hmm. And then you go to the next item is... I'm saying to Carolyn on March 22nd, 1965, I know the police in Cucamonga are setting our friend Zappa up for a bust in a couple of days. I hesitate to warn him for one reason. Can you guess it? Connie Dobbs or Carolyn says, that's easy. We know America's going to draft a lot of young men as it gets more bogged down in Vietnam. We don't want Frank to be drafted, and that can only be prevented if he has some kind of crime on his resume. So you better not warn him. It'll be painful for Frank, but he'll learn a lot about his society from it. He'll be the smarter for it and make better music to assist our purposes. Anyway, his father will... this is what I'm scheming to make an army. Anyway, for the media. His father will get him out of jail very quickly. He doesn't take any guff. Guff! He doesn't take any guff. They're not going to be able to kill Frank and send him to jail or guff. That's what Carolyn says. And I said, yeah, you're right. I have no choice but to let the detective do it. So he got framed and went to jail for 10 days. And you can read my interview with Frank after he died, through the Evergreens, talking about the meaning of that experience. That's pretty good, eh? Little did I know in 1962 that I'd be talking to the dead Frank 32 years later. So, and have access to him. Now the next part is find this. Did I miss a part? Oh yeah, we didn't do April 25th, 62. I say, Frank, so I met him on the street or someplace, how's the greeting card business over in Claremont? Zappa says, it's not music, but I got a bunch of, but I got a hunch that what I'm learning about business, especially advertising, is going to help me be a better composer. That was pretty avant-garde. Most people were still had those old littered values, stay away from business and commerce. It has nothing to do with the aesthetic, lofty regions of art. Then I said, do you think Don Fleet will learn as much in the shoe business? Because he was a shoe salesman at the time. Zappa laughed and turned on his tape recorder. He always was taping people. And I said, I met a genius the other day over in Cucamonga. Zappa says, oh? I said, his name is Paul Buff, and he has this amazing studio. Now, remember, many years later, Carol is wearing his T-shirt. I know Paul Buff personally. And we call up Paul Buff and get him to look at the book where Carol's picture's in it with the T-shirt, that Women of New York book. His name is Paul Buff, and he has this amazing studio. It has the most advanced recording equipment I've ever seen, out here in the sticks, no less. I told him about you and Don. He says, you're welcome to visit and look it over any time. Zappa says, give me his address, and I'll go over tonight. I say, sure, but if you keep that tape recorder running, you're going to owe me millions. So it turned out that Zappa already knew about the Paul Buff studio and wasn't telling me.
Oh.
So that was the sneaky Frank. Because he'd already, I think he met Paul Buff earlier that year or in 61. And he was already going over the studio, so he kept it close to himself. And then that's when I asked, if you're going to change the music business, that's November 1st, 62, later in the year. And then then Frank's on March 22nd, 65, he's going to get busted. And that's true. He lost his, you know, he wasn't able to get drafted. And so therefore he was able to run around stirring up shit in the media, because he had a record. Hey, am I not lucky? Are you there, man? Did your phone drop off? Let's check that. Yes, his phone dropped off. Who's that? Is that you? Bert? Under the block. There he is. So, you're back, Bert. So, 916-342. Who are you, 916-342?
Bob.
Yeah, Bert.
Hear me? Okay. Yeah. My Skype cut off, and I had to dial back in.
Right. So what is what was the last sentence you heard? Oh, it's just explaining how lucky he was that he got busted and that he was able to stay away from the draft and then run around America and do his media pranks.
Wow. That's amazing when you look at when you first met him in 58 and all the synchronistic connections that you had with him after that.
Yes. Well, he was the new leading edge in art. He was going to be. So that's what the Secret Council 10 did. We stayed in touch with the leading edge of all kinds of institutions. That's what, because my bosses were trying to figure out where they could get back into the scene. They'd been sidelined by World War One. It was the ancient oligarchic money. And the money had become public property in the 30s with the welfare state, so having big money personally, privately, was not that significant. Until the late 70s, early 80s, when the welfare state bankrupted itself, and they had to go to private money repositories, gold and credit, to keep the currency thing going.
Wow.
So on May 2nd, 1967, I'm talking to McLuhan. Oh, you going to say something?
No. Go ahead. I just see something happen in 1967, but go ahead and cover the McLuhan in 67. I see something in June 18th that's interesting.
Right. So on May 2nd, I say to McLuhan, having heard Zappa's song, Call Any Visible, what do you think? He says, so I played that for him, Call Any Vegetable. And I had known what McLuhan had said about vegetables. Oop, what's that? Somebody else here? Did you want to say something, 9-6-3-4-2? No. So, mute that. So, McLuhan says, I once wrote an article called The Southern Quality back in 46 or 47 where I explained why there was no human life on this planet. Since then, human beings have been grown inside programmed media environments that are essentially like test tubes. That's the image of the Matrix 32 years later. That's why I say the kids today live mythically in quotes. I've long considered them as vegetables. Zappa seems to have an inkling of this. Call Any Vegetable. And so I said, I'll let him know what you said. I don't know if he has read any of your books. Turned out, within the year or so, I found out he read the little black book, the popular book, The Medium is the Massage. In the June 1st, 67, that is a meeting with Don Van Vliet, otherwise known as Captain Beefheart. So this is leading up to Monterey Pop, which was like Bloomsday, June 16th, I think. Vliet says, Bob, we've been invited to play at this hippie festival up in Monterey in a few weeks. I don't know whether I want to be associated with such a crowd scene. What do you think I should do? I said, when does it happen? It starts on Friday, June 16th, Don says. I go, ha-ha, Bloomsday, which is the date of Ulysses, which we will play a little later tonight. Well, to me, you represent the autonomy of the flesh under satellite conditions, free of all crowds and media. Obviously, to maintain that image, for me, you've got to avoid Monterey. Don says, but I don't think the band understands the purpose of my image. They're musicians, and they want to be heard by as many people as possible. I say, remember earlier when I told you about Rai returning to the Plane of Essence, which had happened 5 months before, and how there is no more doubleness in consciousness? Vliet says, yes. Remember the word doublet, seeing double in the McLuhan Do line? Doublet.
Yeah.
To see double, I think it is. So, there's no more doubleness in consciousness. Beefheart says, yes, I remember. Well, with that in mind, isn't it interesting you have a band member whose name is Rai Cooter? Vliet starts to smile. And since you're the great punster, why not have Rai, alias Rai, leave the band just before the concert? You'd make a situational pun on this historic moment in human consciousness, and you'd have the perfect alibi of why he wouldn't have to go to the festival. Vliet, laughing, says, yes, that would be an impressive sculpture, but how am I going to convince Rai to leave without him catching on? I say, you'll think of something. You've got a history of eccentricity to exploit. He's young. He won't figure it out for a long time. So what happened is that a few days later, Beefheart's doing a concert, and he falls off the stage. He's sort of acting up. He falls off the stage, and Rai Cooter leaves. He's disgusted to work with a singer who can't even stand up. So that's how Beefheart got rid of him. He did figure it out. I didn't tell him to do that.
Hey, he's an interesting character, but that's Captain Beefheart. Because I remember hearing you talk about him before, about that maybe he faked his death or something.
Yes. Yep. That's what Ian says.
Yeah.
Now, in June 18th, 1967, that's when I get everybody together at that bar, what's it called? Stanley's in East Village, where Bowart used to work at. And I've got all these people together, Zappa, LaRouche, McLuhan, my army, before they don't know each other. But they're saying various things, and Zappa says, the kids today are going to be different. They're going to allow things to happen, perhaps even have their cake and eat it too. Then McLuhan says, but wait until they discover books. Zappa says, when will that occur? McLuhan says, when they get into their 30s and 40s. And I say, We and all our activities are drugs for the gaping maw. So then I have a little note. Bob returned to the table and knows Zappa with eyes akimbo, leafing through Connie's copy of Finney's Wake had been left on the counter. Dobbs drew Frank's attention to the song on the radio right then. It was I'm Sorry by the Impalas. Bob noticed Mark Lane. He wrote one of the first exposés of the Watergate Commission, Kennedy assassination. Bob noticed Mark Lane passing on the street in front of Stanley's, probably heading home to his flat in Murray Gross's building. Murray was a lawyer who worked in the DA's office and had carved out an expertise in the new field of securities laundering by the mafia. Now, Murray Gross busted the mafia and had a pretty tense time for a couple of years, getting in his car every day expecting to blow up. He eventually quit the DA's office in New York in the early middle 70s. I end up meeting him 93, because he's running, he and another guy are running the Finnings Wake Society. So Murray becomes a friend. Years later, I found out that Mark Lane wrote his book in Murray Gross's building, which he'd owned since 1963. So I'm saying then, as if I know it's Murray Gross's building, but I actually didn't know till 30 years later or 25 years later. But I'm just saying the fact that he was heading, that Mark Lane was heading home to his flat in Murray Gross's building. So one of the major Kennedy assassination books opened up the cover-up, so to speak, was written in Murray Gross's building, and in the very room where we would hold our Finney's Wake Society 25 years later, and Murray, what else? And he took on the mafia, you know, like a Mae Brussels operation a few years after this. So that's a nice synchronicity. So anything else? Then Krishnamurti gives his talk. Zappa says, in response to Krishnamurti, he says, about 10 years ago, I started reading up on Zen Buddhism. So that would be when he's 17, 18 in high school. About 10 years ago, I started reading up on Zen Buddhism, and it helped me to drop my Catholic conditioning. Krishnamurti sounds like Zen to me, and so I enjoyed his talk. Although speaking as a composer, I agree with Alan Watts' objections to John Cage's use of Zen Buddhist inspiration in his musical compositions. Music being a technological experience today, I would say Mr. McLuhan has a more accurate diagnosis of the problems confronting the modern-day composer who refuses to die. Wouldn't a society that needs all the friends it can get use a force as powerful as today's popular music? Wouldn't a society that needs all the friends it can get use a force as powerful as today's popular music? He then used that line a year later when he wrote an article for Life magazine on the new music. He ended his article with that question. So then, is there any more? So the next time I'm in L.A., I go to the log cabin where he had a place. Tom Mix is the famous cowboy movie star of the 20s. And there's a book out, came out a few years ago, where this guy, you know, he's paranoid, and he lays out there's this huge CIA conspiracy to create the Neil Young, Buffalo Springfield, David Crosby, Stills, Nash music scene out of Lower Canyon Boulevard, headquartered in Log Cabin by Frank Zappa. I think Frank, because his father worked in the military, is working for some agenda. So that guy, that's what happens when you don't encounter my holy offices. You end up making books like that. So I don't think there's any more Zappa in for many years in the diary. I don't know where the next one is. So that's the early years. An amazing life, Frank.
Yes.
Or me, I had.
Both of you. Unfortunately, he's not able to enjoy it like you right now.
Right. So listen to this. Yeah, I'm like Ulysses. He's going through all these adventures and tragedies, and his men all die at different phases, or they're wrecked. I don't know if he keeps getting new crews, but they die. In the end, he's all by himself. So that's where we got here. Until Ion showed up, then everybody was back together with me. So in October 28, 1968 in London, I took my father to a Zappa concert at the Royal Albert Hall in London.
Ooh.
So the diary, October 28, 68, says, Bob and his father, Rene, were leaving the Royal Albert Hall in an inspired state. They had just attended a Mothers of Invention concert. I say, I'm very happy to have finally had the opportunity to introduce you to Frank Zappa after all these years of telling you stories about my adventures with him. Rene says, yes, your friendship with him makes more sense now. I can see how he's going to help us in our plans. He may be at the start of a career that will do for music what Phineas Wake did for literature. He reminds me of both Wyndham Lewis and James Joyce, a mixture of their sensibilities, but in an American context. I get a better sense of American culture watching and listening to Zappa. I say, yes, I can see that. For example, when the band did that little skit about, quote, taking progress and putting it under a rock, unquote, if you think of a rock as representing electric software and progress as representing the old linear industrial hardware, then Frank's got it right about the present state of American and consequently global culture. Rene says, yes, he's a Mozart slash Beethoven for our satellite culture. It was a wonderful concert, even for an old man like me.
Wow. That's powerful, Bob. That's really powerful.
My cool father.
Yes.
He was, how old was he then? 68, 80, so 10, 78, 8. He was 86 then. He'd live another 8 years.
He was cool, man, because, I mean, think about his age in 1968 to hear a rock, well, not
right.
rock, I don't even hear Zappa, and to come out with it with that insight is really, he is, well, I mean, that's, he was your father, Bob.
yeah, he had to be that smart to be my father.
Yes. Wow, that's powerful. Yes, he's a Mozart Beethoven for our satellite culture. Wow.
And that's what
that's
happened in the Secret Council 10. They were the most advanced minds because they knew what was happening, knew the history, and had access to the new information as soon as it was coming out, the new technology. So he wasn't a genius, but his experience put him on the leading edge just by knowing what was going on. You can see a whole series of conversations I had with him in the late 50s, early 60s, up till about 64, where he's, quote, teaching me what he thinks is going to happen in our profession.
So when did the Secret Council of Ten recognize the effect of the satellite? Was it because they heard it from McLuhan and that's why they sent you to investigate him?
No, the satellite is a few years later. They sent me to him because he had written his first essay in 53 in his journal, the Explorations Journal, about how the medium was a message. And
okay,
that government is by technology, not by ideologies and that. And 99% of humanity didn't know that. But McLuhan had figured it out, partly due to knowing Wyndham Lewis and reading Lewis. So the intelligence agencies knew that, at least the advanced levels. They understood that. And they had to, because they were in charge of everything and had to be on top of protecting people, supposedly. So then when Sputnik went up, and that caused a big problem between Russia and the United States, Soviet Union and America, the Secret Council 10 was monitoring that really closely. So they could, just on a practical level, know the satellite was creating a new scene.
Mm-hmm.
And it would affect culture, too. I mean, by the late 60s, people are saying, I want to do my own thing. That means they want to float around the planet like a satellite and be above, transcend, go around the TV, radio, media culture. So Zappa operated from the satellite position and satirized the other satellites, or the attempt of people becoming satellites.
Yeah, that's a hell of a compliment.
Yeah. What do you mean, a compliment? Am I complimenting
Zappa, because, I mean, your father first says that he's a combination of Wyndham Lewis and James Joyce.
Who he knew both of.
Yeah, and then at the end says he's a Mozart Beethoven.
Right.
That's awesome.
And, you know, you could, most people didn't see that. They weren't seeing all the Zappa concerts. They were dealing with Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band and the Rolling Stones and that stuff. So they didn't know that Zappa was conducting with hand signals and had, you know, was basically infiltrating pop culture from a very advanced, artistic, knowledgeable position. And you had to know Frank to know that's what he's doing. And you can. There's an album. I think it's that concert, Playground Psychotics. He put out a couple of CDs in the late 80s, early 90s, that were from those concerts in the Royal Albert Hall. He did a couple there, one in 67, one in 68. And I think that's the one we attended, October 28, 68. You can look that up. Only my father, there's no person in the world who would get, I sort of knew that, but, and I might have even said that to him. He's a Mozart Beethoven, so he might have been repeating what I told him and agreeing with it. But it wasn't hard for him to see that because he was aware of what was going on in the society.
Yeah.
My father was a McLuhanite before McLuhan.
Yeah.
By the traditions of his job.
Yeah. I mean, that just blows me away because I was exposed to classical music and I enjoyed it. But then as you got older, you know, Jimi Hendrix, the whole 70s scene, I always had a question in the back of my mind, like, why isn't there any modern day composers? And now after...
Right.
Being exposed to you and then listen to Zappa, that, I mean, he is the last original music composer.
Yep. And remember, in the movie 200 Motels was made in 1970, he comes out in 71, he would not stay with the other band members on the road because he didn't want to get busted for their dope that they were doing. He knew he was being watched. And so he shows himself in his own lonely hotel room writing out composing on composing paper. That's what he did on the road. He wrote like a composer on that paper, you know, that musical paper that you do it on. That's what he's doing. He shows himself. Ringo Starr is doing it and playing him. And what Zappa is doing, he's writing out this music frantically, and he turns on the radio and just sees what pop music is on, and to pick up the rhythms of the day. It's like looking at McLuhan would look at advertising, and he suss out the rhythms and then do a satire of it and write it down note by note. So he shows Ringo Starr in a frenzy of creativity, turning on the radio, spilling his coffee on the composing paper, and writing stuff down. He's like, oh boy, you know, ripping off the media like Dylan was doing. It's a very accurate presentation of what one does when you're ahead of the game in 68.
By the way, that was big, what you told me earlier when I first came on, that Bob Dylan, you found out that Bob Dylan was just copying...
Media information.
Media.
And quoting scenes from movies.
Yeah.
I should get the book and read that. Nah, it's a long chapter, but I don't know. Some examples, but look at it. There's hardly anybody here now. There is, according to Bill, there's 50 or so people listening on computer, but they're just sitting here waiting for me to drop dead or something. I don't know what. They don't call in and participate. They're just observing this odd phenomenon. But what we were just saying. So Zappa was. So there it is. He's a rock star. He's looking like a punk rock star, or beginning to be a star, and nobody has a clue he's a composer. He's doing what Beethoven did.
Yeah.
And when he lists on Freakout 179 names of who influenced him, and he says, please don't hold against them, he lists, you know, many, many modern composers that people wouldn't even know of back then, unless they were in the business, in the classical world. I mean, this is for a teenage album. So he was educating the kids, like McLuhan was doing.
Yes, that changes a lot of perspective as far as music. I mean, for me to know about his composure, and but then it shows you how there aren't any left, any really musicians. I mean, there are people playing music now, but like, would you consider? That's what the question. Would you consider now people who strive to be musicians now? It's obsolete to be a musician.
Yes, even the myths of traveling are ridiculous now. You have to travel a lot and perform for crowds and keep your chemical body out there, whereas you didn't have to, you know, in the 70s and 80s. You'd spend 2 years, you know, stoked up on coke and making your studio album.
And
you could just have your own private fantasy world. But, you know, I hear a lot about this from Dave Neufeld. He tells me what's going on in the music industry, and it's almost no fun now. For people, unless you're just, you know, testosterone-driven kids, they get pretty wiped out pretty quickly. I have something to say about that. I'm going to do later, not tonight, but in a couple weeks, I think. I'm going to address that. So you have people like, I think his name is John Adams. He writes, you know, traditional classical music, but sort of made modern in some way. And for orchestras that are publicly funded, you know, the whole classical music scene is... You got towns with orchestras, and they either can't survive or they have to be. The government has to support them. It's just there's no ground for that kind of composing. So Zappa, he's a composer, but he hardly was recognized for years by the classical world. And he'd have a lot of problems with when he'd hire orchestras to play for him. They wouldn't take it seriously because he was some long-haired hippie musician-looking guy, rock musician. They didn't think he had any brains.
Did you just say that they recognized him, or they never recognized him?
They didn't. They didn't recognize him till 92, when he was given an acknowledgement at the Frankfurt Festival with John Cage. John Cage died that year, either had died or was going to die, and Frank dies a year later. But what he would do is save up his, you know, rock income from his, you know, albums and that, and pay orchestras to do his classical music, which was the rock sons, the rock songs done in classical media, classical instrumentation. Here's Cosmic Awareness describing Zappa. So this is December 21st, 1969. In Seattle, I'm with Dave Wurster staying at his scene. Carol and I are, and so I said, would awareness, meaning cosmic awareness that came through Wurster, or whatever it was Wurster was doing, would awareness comment on the musical ideas of Frank Zappa? Says Wurster, in brackets, in trance while lying on a couch. Wurster, or awareness, says, this awareness indicates that this entity is one who moves and collects response from many areas. That's an accurate statement. He studied Ravi Shankar, Asian music, Bulgarian music, pretty well everything all around the world, you know? So he moved and collected response from many areas. That these become a kaleidoscope to be embroidered for the texture of sound. Texture, that's like tactility. This awareness indicates that each of these then become an entrance from a two-dimensional system into many other areas of visualization. He went on to say that his Hot Rats, which had come out around this time, was a movie for your ears. So visualization for your ears. So I go, was this entity a famous musician in a previous life? This awareness indicates this is negative, that this entity's previous life action is one involved with a stone and a glass and mosaics, this in areas of North Africa, that this entity also was an architect involving certain mosques. Now, there's actually in one of his albums, I think it's Uncle Meat, where he's carving. It's like the sounds of that life are in this guy sort of carving and using these instruments on stone. That's what it sounds like when you hear it. So would awareness comment on the ideas of Marshall McLuhan and the significance of their application? This awareness indicates that this entity, in breaking through strands of certain gauges and screens, has seen a view of which becomes of itself an action. That's very accurate. And an understanding that each of the gauges is a screen that is placed before the real action also determines the extent to which entities may approach the real action before breaking through these screens and gauges. This awareness indicates in this manner the various apparatus, organization, mechanical, or structured concept may be considered as gauges and screens before the real action, that which is seen in relation to each of these gauges or screens is the limitation which one may approach the real action. Hence, the medium is the message, that's in quotes, is an indication of the limitation to which entities may move through these filters and colorations. So that's a very accurate statement. Media are gauges and screens before the real action, which would be along lines of Ion's emphasis on living without being influenced by media. Now, it's very hard to do, and it can be criticized as an essentialist view of reality. There's an essence that you tap into, but Ion definitely is not an essentialist, the way the critics say of it. Ion is a doctrine of analogical proportionality, the Thomas Aquinas doctrine. He's more of that. So, would awareness comment on the ideas of Buckminster Fuller? This awareness indicates that these emanate great strength and light, yet those points of intrinsic value create a limitation in certain areas through specifics inclined to be involved in thoughts which are not entirely open to the creative change which must come to every part to live. So that's probably pretty accurate about Bucky Fuller. So there's that. There's the Zappa thing. Now, it's before we go on to Drucker, let me just say, is there another one?
There's a Dennis you speak about, discuss Zappa in April 8th, 1970.
Oh, okay. April 8th, 1970. And July 23rd, 72, we should do that. Yeah. April 8th. Right. So I'm pretending I don't know who Zappa is to the young Dennis. Dennis says, I've been sitting in on the recording sessions of a new kind of musician by the name of Frank Zappa. He's got a new group called Hot Rats. He's unbelievably creative. I go, come on, Dennis. As I've told you before, creativity is obsolete. Dennis says, well, you haven't been around this Zappa guy. So I don't tell him. I'm forming a subcult of zombies to work for me, and they're not going to be told what's really going on. So then, Dennis, later, in November of 71, November 19th, he's speaking to Calvin Schenkel, who designed Zappa's album covers. So I guess Dennis told me this. Listen, Calvin, I will have that check ready for you by tomorrow. Frank called me this morning from Europe about it and says we owe it to you. It says we owe it to you. Calvin Schenkel, great. Thanks, Dennis. By the way, when are you going to audition for Frank's band again? I think you can make it now. Listening to you last night at the club, I could see you'd have no problem. So Dennis goes on to live in L.A., work for Zappa, and almost gets in the band. He doesn't, but this is what this is about. Dennis says, yeah, I feel confident too. Playing for Zappa is like being in a military operation. But he knows I'm looking to be in the band when he gets back from this tour. But unfortunately, he never gets it, never makes it. Okay, did you say another date? Okay, July 23rd. This is a good one. In Los Angeles, Zappa turning is when he was laid up from the accident that almost killed him in December of 71. So he's laid up still in a wheelchair. He says, Zappa turning his wheelchair towards Bob. He says, say that again. So I say, the satellite environment works on four levels. First, the broadcasting level. Second, the broadcatching level, or general surveillance. Third, the narrowcasting level for intelligence purposes purchased by corporations and governments. And the fourth is narrowcatching for monitoring the third level. You got it? And Zappa says, I've been doing the first two levels of my music, but I think you've clarified what I've got to add to my musical concept. And I go, yeah, you've been on the right track with your satellite conductor notion, but now you can refine it. So that's an important conversation right there with Frank. And what's the next one? Is there any more Zappa to flow through?
You meet with Dennis in 1975, February 27th, and you discuss.
Okay, so we talk about Frank. Okay.
Yes, Frank and Captain Beefheart.
Okay, so this is February 11th?
27th. February 27th. 1975.
February 27th, okay. Dennis says, I feel good, Bob. It's great to be alive. The good news is Captain Beefheart is getting back together again with Zappa. The Mothers are going to tour again in a few weeks, and I'm handling promotions. Music is the best. Then I say, music is what's holding society together now. It's both a fascist anesthetic and a Dionysian release. But Dennis, the situation will have no staying power in the long run. So it'll be interesting to see what your musician god Zappa does when that problem surfaces. So I'm being rather detached about the Zappa guy. And so we're sitting on a bench in downtown Dartmouth. And I go, sitting on a bench in front of Sutherland's Pond on the Creighton Avenue side, Bob wanted to mention the new Fellini movie that was in town, but he was interrupted by Dennis complaining about a recent article in Village Voice by Ron Rosenbaum that reported on a convention of assassination researchers in Boston. That would be the convention where Mae Brussel met Sherman Skolnick. That was like middle of February, 75. So then the next, I say to Dennis, Dobbs says, June 16, 76, with the satellite environment, you can broadcast, broadcast, narrowcast, and narrowcast simultaneously. Dennis says, that sounds like the idea Zappa uses in his theatrical projects. So I don't tell him, well, Zappa got the idea for me. Okay, so here it is. I'm talking to a bunch of people, including Dennis, and I go, he says, so I go, what's happening with Zappa? And he says, I got laid off. This is January 1778. He's suing Warner Brothers and Herbie Cohen, so things have changed a little around Frank. And on top of that, I never made the band. So I left L.A., and I'm back looking around for something new. I'm not thinking about anything in music, though. Hey, where's Bob Dobbs? Oh, wait, no, he's saying this to Randy. Okay, Randy is saying this. So what's happening with Zappa? I got laid off, he's suing, I'm back looking around. I'm not thinking about anything in music, though. Hey, where's Bob Dobbs? I can't find him over in Dartmouth. And Randy says, he and Connie moved away. He's in Dallas and Connie's in Toronto. But Steve's still in Toronto, too. Dennis says, I'm going to Toronto next week. Have you got his number? Randy says, yes. And then, as a note, but Dennis didn't hear Randy. But Dennis didn't hear Randy when Randy said yes, because he was drowned out by a college student whose car radio was shouting, Peaches in Regalia, which is a famous Zappa song. So I'm saying the car radio, he was playing that in his car, and I'm saying the car radio is shouting Peaches in Regalia, anthropomorphizing the car. So that Zappa, what's the next one? August 28th, 1979. I say, Frank, you hit the nail on the head with that theme of banning music in Joe's garage. This is right when the Shah, what was his name, the Ayatollah Khomeini had just taken over in Iran. Zappa, yeah, look at what the Ayatollah is doing in Iran. I go, oh, yes, but I want to warn you, there's going to be a rise in fundamentalist political activity here in America, mainly through the Republican Party over the next few years. Your scenario will look more like the news than science fiction. Zappa says, if you're right, then those are some of my worst fears come true. I say, it's unfortunate, but it's going to knock the wind out of a lot of the mood of electric autonomy that motivated much of the frenzy of the 70s. Then it says, Frank turned back to his editing console, but he also turned on his television to catch the news. So that's where Zappa talks about someone warning him about the rise of the fundamentalists in the early Reagan period. And this was a year before Reagan became president. Or 8 months, and Zappa, this is the time when I told him about it. This is the informing of Frank of something that would put him ahead of everybody else in terms of what was going to happen under Reagan with the moral majority. Hey?
Yeah.
What do you think of that?
Yeah. So you were connected with, how did you know that it was coming, may I ask?
Well, Beter, I knew the same people Beter knew, and Beter was saying that in 79, so it was on the Beter recordings.
Mm.
And because the Bolsheviks had knocked off the Rockefellers, and they were going to bring in this device of, you could say, dumbing down of America, or they thought they could do it, just get America divided and yelling and screaming, because, you know, a lot of the sophisticated Americans, liberals, whatever you call them, educated Americans, they couldn't believe that this fundamentalism came back to influence Reagan. The president would be influenced by that. They were shocked by it, and they didn't know why they couldn't stop it and why it spread among the American population. Here's a February 2nd, 1982, I'm talking to Carolyn. I say, why do you think your medical practice is so popular? This is my birthday, February 2nd, 82, in Toronto. And she says, because I listen to my patients. I let them define their problems. You let them create their own body percept, which is a McLuhan word. And she goes, yes, at least in the beginning. So it is a given today that people in America demand the right to have an audience. She says, it seems so. And I say, and that is a new pressure in doctors' lives? And she says, yes. Then the note says, Bob and Connie were interrupted when their son and daughter, adopted twins, born on January 17, 1965, barged into the kitchen with their friend Eddie and demanded to hear again the Frank Zappa album that made fun of televangelists. And Shannon was a born-again Christian around that time, or just before I met her.
Well, that's interesting, that conversation you had with Carolyn in 82. Because her show is really turning into something very special.
Yeah.
I've noticed it's a new way, totally new way for people to become empowered with their own health.
Yeah.
And she's really forcing them to take charge. I like that she gave some good guidance for people to really, like, they need to take charge of their own health. So that's really interesting to see that you all discuss that in 82. Wow.
Yeah, because more and more people. So why did people go to alternative doctors? They wanted to express themselves. They wanted to have an audience for their issues. Everybody was neurotically looking for an audience because society got more and more fragmented and solitudinous, you know, solitude. So people would use their doctors to have someone to talk to, like going to a psychiatrist. And alternative doctors took the time. Regular medicine didn't. So that's what Carolyn is understanding, that if she does that, you know, she'll be a popular doctor. And she did it naturally anyway. So that's, and McLuhan had written that everybody was screaming to have an audience by the mid-70s, and a chemical body audience.
Yes.
It was like the joke, or the album cover, everybody's in showbiz.
It reminds me of the Do line where McLuhan predicted Reagan, but the governor needs to be a showman, politics.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, in 1968, he said, politics becomes show business and show business becomes political. And that happened, unfolded. I mean, show business is political, is the political correctness, the anti-abortion stuff, all those new rules in the society that Hollywood had to pay attention to. McLuhan predicted that generally as the group mind takes over. with everybody protecting, I would add, protecting their particular technological mix. You know, what ratios of technology and values and memes they are going to defend. That's
yeah.
their mythic stage. So, on August 14th, 1984, in New York, Bob skirted the edges of the dance floor in the Limelight Disco Club, which was on the corner of 20th Street, West 20th Street, and 6th Avenue. We'd end up doing the nonlinear circle just down the street from that disco. And that disco, in the 70s, was the home for William Irwin Thompson's Lindisfarne organization funded by Lawrence Rockefeller. So, I'm in the Limelight Disco Club, and it says, former home of William Irwin Thompson's Lindisfarne Association. Bob was looking for Frank Zappa. Bob suspected Frank was on the edges, meeting of the club. Bob was correct. Frank was in a back room holding court with a few fans. Well, everybody else is just discoing away there, bouncing about. Bob waited for his opportunity to speak. Frank, have you heard of Mae Russell? He says, yes, I read something by her in Larry Flint's magazine, The Rebel. Are you interested in more? Perhaps. What have you got? I have tapes of her weekly radio show. I can send a few to you. He says, sure, I'd like to hear them. I said, what do you think of Flint's campaign about the explosion of KAL-007? That happened on September 1st, 1983. And this is a year later. I gave him some legal advice for his newspaper ads right after it went down. I say, those ads were what brought May and Larry together. And Zappa goes, really? I go, yes, it was after Larry Flint met May that he decided to create a magazine for her. That's why The Rebel came into existence. And Zappa says, but the magazine doesn't exist anymore. And I said, yes, Larry Flint got put in jail and May Brussels was isolated again in Carmel, California. So a year later, Frank phones May, gets some information on the politician he's going to confront when he deals with the rock censorship issue on September 19, 1985. And then after that, he gives May a computer in reward for how she helped him.
Yeah, you posted that video or something when Frank...
Yes. Yeah, we played the recording of the hearing.
Yes.
Here's something. September 5th, 1985, I write out the meeting of Zappa and Mae Brussels. Zappa says, May, this is... Well, it's on the phone. Zappa, May, this is Frank Zappa. I've heard a lot about you from our mutual friend, Bob Dobbs. And I was hoping you could help me with some concerns I have. May says, maybe I can. What's on your mind? Zappa says, there's a committee in Washington that's pursuing legislation for the purpose of censoring music industry products. I was wondering if you had any information on some particular politicians who may be behind this legislation. And May says, who do you have in mind? And the rest is history. That's all I have, that part.
March 2nd, 1987, Dennis meets with Nelson to discuss Frank Zappa.
Okay. Well... March 1st, March 87. What are you saying? And then March 2nd,
March 2nd.
The next day.
March 2nd. Yeah.
And March 1st, too. So,
March.
So these are, now this is Bob's scene in New York. You know, I've got some young people. I'm growing into a little mini army, a mini state. So I'm with Alan. Bob turned off the bootleg video of Frank Zappa's 1984 concerts at the Pier in New York City. So that thing we played tonight is later that year, you know, in November or something in Los Angeles. No, July 21st. No, okay, so we were at the Pier in August. So the thing we played tonight was performed a month before we saw Frank in New York City. So I say, Alan, there's something I want to explain to you about Krishnamurti. That may throw new light on your obsession with them. Alan says, what's that? You know how Krishnamurti has repeatedly emphasized for decades the simple process of cognition and how it conditions us. Alan nodded. That knowledge came out of the theosophical circles that nurtured Krishnamurti and subsequently many artists in the early decades of this century. However, James Joyce was unique at that time because he saw first how that knowledge could be applied to the stages of collective cognition in cultures and their rituals. As the 20th century has unfolded, we can see how the private stages of cognition would be an increasingly puny issue and why Krishnamurti would appear more eccentric and McLuhan, Krishnamurti's logical heir, would appear more resonant. And the analysis is, what happened to Joyce, James Joyce? It was McLuhan's sole understanding of Joyce that put him past Krishnamurti. Alan says, I don't think I completely understand what you're telling me. Perhaps you could recommend some stuff I could read to get some background on this. I say, no problem. And Alan says, okay, now put the Zappa tape back on. I love, quote, Hot Plate Heaven at the Green Hotel, unquote. We hear an excerpt of that tonight. I go, no problem. Now, Nelson, now these people, that would refer to Nelson Thaw, but the character that is called Nelson is the exact opposite of him. And when I would have Nelson referring to the actual Nelson, he'd be called another name. I think it's Ian. So Nelson says, this is the non-Nelson. One of the most interesting things about my visit to Toronto is the tapes of that International Connection show you've been playing me. He's saying this to Dennis. I've had a couple of friends die from AIDS the past year, and the word on the street in New York is that AIDS was created by the government or somebody. You know, it's man-made. This Bob Marshall seems to use sources who believe that, says Nelson. Do you think your former employer, Frank Zappa, has the same information? Dennis says, oh, you picked up on that when I was playing Thingfish the other day, the Zappa Broadway musical or off-Broadway musical about AIDS. Nelson says, yes. And Dennis says, I don't know Bob Marshall, but I've heard that Marshall McLuhan, what is this? Okay, I don't know Bob Marshall, but I've heard that Bob Marshall knows Zappa, and he's definitely mentioned Zappa more than once on a show in casual babble with other DJs. Zappa has always had references about CIA stuff in his music since the 60s. He did a song almost 20 years ago on Ronald Reagan as an agency-controlled, meaning CIA-controlled politician. And Zappa always thought that LSD was a drug introduced into the youth culture by some part of the government. Did you ever see that booklet that came with the Uncle Meat album that shows a semi-human vegetable saying he's just been killed by the government because he knew too much? As a matter of fact, the themes in Thingfish, which came out around 84, are implied in the original script for the Uncle Meat movie, which would have been late 60s.